Hello, and welcome to the live webinar, Norwood and BIC Graphic, Product Safety and Compliance, Protect Your Customers and Offer Them Peace of Mind. Sponsored by Norwood and BIC Graphic North America and presented by Promo Marketing and Print and Promo. I'm Colleen McKenna, Managing Editor of Promo Marketing, and I'm pleased to welcome you to today's event. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelist. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets on this console. Please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. Here today to discuss product safety and compliance and how important it is to work with responsible, credible suppliers in order to protect your customers is Joe Cade. Mr. Cade is Vice President and General Counsel for BIC Advertising Promotional Products, where he is responsible for all legal matters of BIC Graphic and Norwood on a global basis, including their product safety and regulatory compliance programs. So without further delay, I'd like to introduce Joe Cade.
Thank you, Colleen. My goal today for everybody is try to take what can be a very complicated and sometimes dry subject and turn it around a little bit and try to make it a little more useful and practical. So we're going to approach it a little differently than it is often approached, and hopefully we can find some tips for people to take out into the field and maybe work a little bit better at what they do when it comes to compliance and product safety issues. So with that, let's get started. Move to the next slide here. I think it's always good to start with the basic question, why worry about all of this? Because there's so many things we need to do. And I think everybody hopefully starts with the first premise, and that is, well, first of all, it's the right thing to do. We want to comply with the law, and we want to sell safe products in our industry. But there's so many reasons that flow into that. For example, your company, whether you're a supplier or distributor, your company's reputation is at stake. You as a professional have a reputation, especially if you're a distributor, and if your customers lose trust in you, it's going to cost you from a business standpoint. I think our industry's reputation and viability can be severely damaged if we don't give this strong attention and make a valiant effort at it, especially when it comes to sales to companies like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Disney, and those with a lot at stake from a brand standpoint. And exactly that on item five, I've heard from executives at those companies, and the first thing that comes to mind is their job in the compliance department is to protect their brand. The Disney brand, Coca-Cola brands are worth about $10 billion, and it's a big hit if they have a recall or a lawsuit and a lot of publicity around that. So that's certainly their number one focus, the reputation of their company. There are also a lot of potential lawsuits out there. I think California produces the bulk of them with Prop 65 claims, and that's because it is a legal system that establishes a big pot of gold for individuals and law firms to go after on a day-to-day basis chasing those claims. So it has created a very lucrative cottage industry for bounty hunters and law firms to team up. There are also consumer advocacy groups, especially mothers who have concerns about heavy metals in toys and child products, and they actually buy equipment like XRF guns to test products, and they will take them to the news or to government agencies if they find excessive heavy metals in those products. And I think recently we've seen some things that have really gotten our attention. The Consumer Product Safety Commission just issued its largest fine ever for a violation of CPSC laws against Ross Stores, $3.9 million for repeated violations of drawstrings in children's upper clothing like sweatshirts, which is a choke hazard, strangulation hazard. It's the largest fine ever, and they'd already been fined $500,000. I think what's important about that, number one, is that the CPSC is trying to make examples, and they've made one of Ross Stores. But more importantly, Ross Stores is not an importer, a manufacturer, or a wholesale supplier. It's a retail seller. And the CPSC says that as a seller, and this speaks to distributors, you have an obligation to make sure that the products you sell are compliant and safe. And then what really gets my attention in item 9 there is someone just went to prison for 20 months for violating the CPSIA for importing products that had excessive lead, phthalates, and small part violations. And there's some other companies that have been indicted criminally. So the CPSC is putting people in jail now. So let's go to the next slide. I think this really summarizes the whole presentation. What is compliance? We think of it as product safety laws and whether or not the product meets that law, and that's certainly a large part of it. But generally, it's not just federal but also state laws. It's not just chemical limits, but it's also labeling in a lot of cases. The products need to be safely designed and made. For example, if a lock blade pocket knife does not lock, that's probably going to be a safety hazard and possibly a recall problem. Same thing with a lawn chair that tips over and an elderly person breaks a hip. That's a recall problem and a lawsuit waiting to happen as well. So an evaluation of a proposed product of those types needs to be done. Honoring intellectual property rights, especially patents, but also trademarks and copyrights, is something that should be done. We've got to honor the import requirements by placing country of origin marking on products that are imported from outside of the U.S. And there's some rules about what chemicals can come in through the ports. Those would be in liquids, putties, paste, gels, or powders. So there's some things to honor there. Truth in advertising, I think, is becoming more important. Eco claims are very popular now, but also made in USA, and we're going to talk about that in a little more detail later. There's some antimicrobial health claims that are sometimes made about products that have an additive that may kill germs, but also over-the-counter drug claims, and especially with sunscreens, a new law that came into effect in December. We'll talk about that in detail. Obviously, quality assurance has been important since the beginning of time. The fit, form, and function of a product, as well as the imprint quality, is always there, and customers will be the enforcers there by returning the products. And sustainable development, and especially the middle one, social responsibility, safe and reasonable working conditions for factories overseas that we source from, a very fast growing issue with a lot of major brand companies. So that's what we're going to talk about, but let's back up and at least enjoy some beginning good news, and that is, as a general rule, the products in our industry are not inherently dangerous. There are a few that have some special issues, but bags and keychains and writing instruments generally are not hazardous by themselves. So there are going to be some laws on a lot of these, but we're not selling promotional cribs, for example, very much. So we get to, I guess, take a deep breath on that concept alone. Also, we haven't had a lot of problems with recalls and a lot of bad publicity and big lawsuits yet, and we want to keep it that way. And frankly, if you as a distributor or a supplier can do just a few basic things, you can reduce your risk tremendously just by following a few pretty simple steps. So let's take a look at some of those. If you can, and sometimes your customer wants a particular product, but if you can focus on a low-risk product, that's certainly an area where you can reduce exposure. Paper goods tend to be low-risk, whether it's a calendar, a sticky note, notebooks, things like that. Very few legal standards apply, and very few ways someone can get hurt. So it's an example of a low-risk product. Also, products that are made by very large brand companies, even if it's something as serious as Tylenol, and Tylenol does have an occasional recall, but I don't think anyone in our industry is going to be able to outperform the Tylenol compliance and quality assurance department. So relying on that, even though there is an occasional recall, I think is something that will reduce risk as opposed to buying imported or generic pain relievers. But also, whether it's food like Mars Candy or golf, these companies have big brands and tremendous expertise, and you really reduce your risk when you work with them. Plus, you can sell the brand itself. Usually, the product's going to be a better quality anyway. Cost a little bit more, but you get more. You can work with manufacturers within the U.S. or in other low-risk countries like Europe and Canada. So that's just a few ways to consider lower-risk products. You could also look to lower-risk suppliers. Again, manufacturers within the U.S. or other lower-risk countries. You might look for suppliers who can provide you with a current passing test report for the products that they sell. You know, that should be a question that's asked quite often, especially with the more regulated products in our industry. You might ask if they're accredited as a member of QCA, for example, the Quality Certification Alliance, which is there to increase the quality and compliance of suppliers in our industry and therefore the products that go through our industry, or an ISO certification like 9001, which is a quality-based system where you can't get certified without an intense amount of auditing and work and systems in place. So some areas to look for. Does a supplier have a product safety department? Actually, people that are trained and focused on that issue in particular. Are they knowledgeable about these things? Is the supplier careful about what they claim in their catalogs and their other advertising material? If they're loose about claims, they might not be as focused about compliance. So just some of the things that you can consider when you're considering suppliers. So let's talk about where some of the major risks are, and we'll go over these in a little detail. We've got, obviously, paint and imprint inks, mainly heavy metals and primarily lead and possibly cadmium. We'll talk about that in a sec. PVC is probably our number one issue right now, and it's phthalates, a chemical in PVC. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Electronics are always something of a sensitive nature. We'll talk about that in detail. FDA-regulated products, whether it's over-the-counter drugs, cosmetics, medical devices like bandages and thermometers, or food and drink, like candy or bottled water. And then food and drink contact items, like drinkware and food storage, have some special rules. There are some products that the Federal Hazardous Substance Act requires some special warnings on or prohibitions of. Products that are targeted by the bounty hunters in California under Prop 65 need to be always considered. And then, of course, child products, which tend to be covered in every product safety presentation because there's so many rules there. So let's talk a little bit about paint and imprint inks. What is paint? We know what an imprint ink is. It's applied at the supplier's facility to decorate the product with a logo. But paint is basically anything that can be scraped off with a pocket knife and tested at a lab. If it can't be scraped off, then it's part of the product. So ink on paper that becomes part of the paper is not paint per se because you can't scrape it off. And, of course, you're going to find it applied onto the product by the manufacturer or the imprint ink added by your supplier for decoration. And the main testing focus is on heavy metals. Prop 65 has a lot of claims on imprint inks and paints. And CPSIA, of course, for child products has a number of standards there. So that's an area of concern. Another, well, this is a little more detail on that. I won't spend a lot of time on the numbers and everything, but you can see that for toys, there are a number of heavy metals there that are tested. And imprint ink should be tested for all those heavy metals. Canada actually has lead and mercury as part of the total heavy metals, and if a product is potentially going to be sold in Canada, it might as well go with a stricter standard than just the U.S. version of lead at 90 parts per million. So that's just the basic standards for paint and imprint inks for children's products, by the way. All right, PVC. The question is it made of plastic, number one? If it is, there's a good chance that it's PVC. A lot of bags have PVC backing, and the main standards to consider are lead and PVC, and as a general rule, PVC coming out of China is compliant with the lead standards of Prop 65 and also CPSIA for the most part. But phthalates right now are a serious issue, and there are five phthalates that are at risk in California under Prop 65. If it's a child product, then there are six under CPSIA, slightly different chemicals. So those are the two areas to be concerned if it's PVC. There's a new material that is coming out of China now called phthalate-free PVC, and also PEVA liner for cooler bags, polyethylene vinyl acetate, is going to be compliant for Prop 65 and CPSIA. So there are other materials out there that work. Some of them cost a little bit more, but they are compliant. So if you're going to sell a bag in California, I strongly recommend that you either get a recent fully passing test report for Prop 65 lead and phthalates on the PVC, or get a Prop 65 warning applied to it if it's shipping to California. Now, at the bottom, I say stop. What are phthalates? A lot of people may know this, but phthalates are chemicals that are added to PVC to make them soft and stretchy and durable, but those chemicals are hormone disruptors. They mimic estrogen. So especially for young children, if they have a lot of exposure to phthalates, and especially if they put them in their mouths, it can really disrupt their hormone systems, and it also will result in brain damage over the years. Children will have a much higher chance of growing up with depression and other similar symptoms. So that's why it's becoming so heavily regulated. So let's talk about electronics. We can spend a lot of time here. I just wanted to give you some examples of low risk, medium risk, and high risk products. A USB is pretty low risk. There's not much of a chance that any USB will ever be a shock or a fire hazard or cause any kind of a problem. You get into the mid zone of a USB hub, which is something that may have four ports and can plug into a laptop, and those need to have an overcharge protection device like a fuse in it. Otherwise, it could blow a fuse on a laptop if you're trying to charge, for example, four dead cell phones through a laptop that's plugged into the wall. When you get into car chargers, those are a little more sensitive because car batteries, even though only 12 volts, the electricity flies up and down as the car is driven because the air conditioner goes on and then cuts off and other things happen, and that electricity just goes wild. And it can, if it's not designed and constructed properly, it can actually cause a car fire. It's pretty rare, but it can happen. Then you get into rechargeable lithium-ion batteries. There are recalls on those, so look to see if they are UL certified. Same thing for any kind of plug-in electronics. Transformers must be designed and manufactured just right to transform the power to from high voltage to low voltage. Need ground fault interrupters if the product's used around water, like a hair dryer. again, if you know what you're doing, you can go to the UL website and plug in the manufacturer and the model number of the device and see if it's been UL certified. And if it has, that can give you a tremendous amount of comfort. Otherwise, it needs to be tested. So let's look at FDA-regulated products. Some examples of over-the-counter drugs are sunscreen, pain relievers, Pepto-Bismol, and Purell, these kinds of things. They provide a medical benefit or protection. Cosmetics are applied to the body for beauty purposes, no medical benefit. Medical devices that we might see in our industry include bandages, pill cutters, thermometers, sunglasses, and even laser pointers. And food and drink, you can see some obvious examples there. So these are in or on the body products and need to be dealt with very carefully. Let's just take a look at the new sunscreen rules that came out in December of last year. The SPF value must be validated by testing. And it's interesting, there's no animal testing for this. Human testing is what takes place. And the SPF value must be supported by a scientific test that is a method approved by FDA. Now, a sunscreen does not have to provide UVA, UVB broad spectrum protection. But if you want to claim it, you have to have a test report that says that it passes the FDA test requirement for that. So it shouldn't make that claim on the product without a test report behind it. And I've shown in different colors there the particular claim that can be made in green if it does pass that testing. And essentially, it's a claim that it not only protects against sunburn, but also protects against skin cancer and early skin aging. But if you don't want to test it for UVA, UVB broad spectrum protection, or if you test it and it fails, you can still sell it. You just have to make a different claim, and that's in red. It's basically a warning that this only protects against sunburn and not against skin cancer or early skin aging. Something else about broad spectrum is it not only must pass that test but have an SPF of 15 or more. So you can have it either way. You just have to have a test report to support the broad spectrum claim, and then your language on the label has to be exactly as shown there. So some more about sunscreens. Water-resistant claims are now more closely regulated. You can see if it passes water-resistant testing, then a water-resistant claim can be made. And in green, whatever the results are, 40 or 80 minutes can be claimed of swimming or sweating. And then, of course, immediately after towel drying, reapply. Down at the right below that, though, if it does not pass it or you just don't want to test it for that, you can still sell it. You just can't make a water-resistant claim, and you need to include, in fact, under the drug facts box, comment to use water-resistant sunscreen if swimming or sweating. So there's some prohibited claims now for sunscreens. Can't say sunblock anymore. You can't call it sunblock, only sunscreen. Can't say sweat-proof, only water-resistant. Can't say waterproof or all-day protection or instant protection. All the drug fact boxes require a comment to put it on 15 minutes before getting out in the sun. Have to have an expiration date on sunscreens, and the maximum SPF that can be claimed on a sunscreen is 50+, and that's only if it's tested and the results come back 51 or better. So if you've got some at home that's a 70 or 80 SPF, hopefully those were sold before December 17th. Maybe you have them left over from last summer. I have on the next slide an example that may be hard to see. It's a classic drug fact box for a sunscreen. This is an SPF 30 that does not have the UVA, UVB broad spectrum protection claims or the water-resistant claims, and this needs to be on the package of the sunscreen, which is pretty difficult to squeeze on a small single-use packet. So you might see it broken up on several both sides of the packets, or sometimes on a peel-away label. But this is part of the labeling requirement from December 17th of last year. So let's talk about food and drink contact items. We've got some Prop 65 rules and some FDA rules and then some state rules. They're shown there, and without getting into a lot of detail, it's a combination of the interior cavity, the lip and rim area, and the exterior decorations that are all tested, and it depends on what the material is. Is it glass and ceramic? Is it plastic? Is it metal? Or is it wood? And it's a pretty complicated area. I'll simply say that when it comes to plastic, the complication is logarithmic in nature. You have to know exactly what kind of plastic each of the parts that touch food or drink is to know which test to make, and you have to know what the use of the item is to select the correct test method. So a lot of attention to the bill of materials is needed there. In Connecticut and a few other states, plastic food and drink contact items need to be BPA-free, bisphenol A-free, and that's because BPA has been shown to be similar to phthalates, which are in some PVC, to be hormone disruptors. They also mimic estrogen, and that's why, especially for plastic drinkware for young children, they're prohibited in most states and also by the federal government, and then in some states in all reusable plastic food and drink contact items. There's a bit of a myth that BPA is only found in polycarbonate, and if you don't carry that, then you don't have to worry about it. The answer is it has been found in ABS plastic and polypropylene, so someone claiming BPA-free needs to have it tested to show that there is no BPA in it. Zero BPA. Now, this can be real complicated on the Federal Hazardous Substance Act, so I won't spend too much time on it, but as a general rule, there are items that have something really hazardous about them, but they are used around the house. And an example of this can be bug spray or other cleaners that you find under your sink or in the laundry room. Not too many products in our industry have it, although I can give you a few exceptions. A lot of times, the little glass tube of a carpenter's level that has the bubble in it is not water. The reason is that water will freeze during shipment or in a warehouse. So instead, it's either naphtha or ethylene glycol, which is antifreeze, is put in there, and those are hazardous substances requiring a Federal Hazardous Substance Act warning, as well as a Prop 65 warning. And there are a few other liquid-filled items that would likewise cause that. So those items should not only get those warnings, but they cannot be in child products, and they really should be used and abuse tested to make sure that during normal handling and foreseeable abuse, those chemicals will not come out and people will be exposed to them. Art materials need to be evaluated by a toxicologist to make sure there's nothing toxic in them, and they should be evaluated every 5 years unless the supplier changes or the makeup of the art materials change. And then there's some crazy products I put in there for some of the older people like me. You might remember lawn darts and clackers. These are products that are just banned outright by the CPSC. Dive sticks, where one end floats and the other end sinks because of the diving hazard for children. A lot of tragic accidents there. Kites that have aluminized polyester or electrocution hazards. And really the one that affects us most in our industry would be any ball or small part that's associated with a product that is intended for use by children under three. And the definition of a small part would be that it goes through a choke tube. I don't remember the exact dimension, but it's intended to be roughly the size of a young child's throat. So that's where we would run into trouble if we do, and that's a partially an age grade question and a choke tube question and a use and abuse question. If a product is used and abused, will it break off a piece that'll go through the choke tube, and is it intended for children under three? That's an outright violation. You can't sell it even with a warning. If it's intended for children 3 to 6, you can sell it with a warning. If it's intended for children older than that, you can sell it without a warning. So let's talk about Prop 65. I think everybody knows that when you go to California with your products, you need to have your eyes open. Here's a general rule. This started out as a water pollution law that was voted in by the people, and of course they wanted their water to be clean. They're very environmentally conscious in California, but it got morphed into something much different from that. And the law says that out of the 850 to 900 chemicals that are now on the list in California, if your product has one in excess of the Prop 65 limit and it's sold in California, then it's got to have a Prop 65 warning, and it's a pretty scary warning. It says it contains a chemical the state of California has determined causes cancer, birth defects, or other reproductive harm. That is a permissible warning for a product that exceeds a chemical limit on Prop 65. It's only a California law. The other 49 states do not require that warning and do not have those limits. But California tends to drive a lot of the product change for the other 49 states by default. What are they focusing on in California? Well, certainly ceramic drinkware, and especially decal ink, lead and cadmium is where this tend to get our industry first on some ceramic mugs. I think decal ink, for the most part, is out of our industry. Paint and imprint ink, lead and cadmium primarily, and they tend to go with child standards. For the most part, I think after the recalls of 2007, most of the paints and imprint inks have been revised to be 90 parts per million and less of lead. Lead crystals never going to meet the Prop 65 standard, so it will always require a Prop 65 warning. Lead crystal is 240,000 parts per million lead. The FDA says it's okay to have a glass of wine in a wine glass with 240,000 parts per million lead. California says you have to have that warning on there if it has more than 100 parts per million lead. So you can see the drastic difference between Prop 65 and the FDA. Metal jewelry has lead, and now cadmium, textiles, lead, and some new Halloween costume cases that focused on cadmium, arsenic, and formaldehyde are coming out. The number one problem in our industry when it comes to Prop 65 is phthalates in PVC. I can't emphasize that enough. And something new that is coming out of Prop 65 in California is a flame retardant in polyurethane foam. It's not in our industry, but it's sure getting the furniture makers, especially those of children's furniture, a lot of claims being filed against them. So let's talk about the CPSIA and child products. It's always good to refresh our recollection of the basic rules there. The first thing we need to look at is what does it really apply to? Well, child product is a product that is designed and intended primarily for use by children 12 and under. And if that's the case, the product needs to comply with all of the child product standards, and they differ depending on whether it's a toy, which is going to have play value, or a child care article, which is like a pacifier bib or sippy cup, something like that, which is designed or intended for primarily for children 3 and under for sucking, feeding, and similar things. They all need to meet their respective product safety standards. They all have to be tested by a third-party lab. No in-house testing allowed there. They really should be tested every year, and sometimes more often if the inventory turnover is much quicker. There should be a certificate of compliance available on the supplier's website, and the product should have a tracking label unless it's virtually impossible to put that on there based on the size and the makeup of the product. So almost all will have a tracking label. So age grading of toys and child care articles is very important because different rules apply. For example, the choke hazard rule for small parts that I mentioned a few minutes ago. Again, labeling, tracking label needs to be on these products. And the point there is if it needs to be recalled, there should be sufficient information to know exactly where the product came from, who the manufacturer was, and to be able to retrieve as many as possible that went out into the public. There is also potentially some warnings, such as small parts. There may be user instructions if it's a game, for example. Art materials, maybe you're going to have the hazardous art material label on there. And then, of course, age grade. So lots of potential labeling issues for child products, as well as the name of the supplier that the wholesale supplier that sold them. This next chart is just showing some of the basic standards that apply to child products. And one thing to keep in mind is all standards that apply to general purpose products, those that are not just child products but intended for a full general audience or adult audience, all those standards still apply. And then you add on top of that all the child standards that would apply as well, and that might be lead and mercury in the paint, lead in the actual substrate of the product, the metal or the textile, these kinds of things, or soluble heavy metals in the paint and surface coating and imprint inks if it's on a toy, phthalates in PVC especially, small parts can be there for child products, toys, and child care articles, but also just child products, and then sharp points and edges as well, just some of the key considerations for compliance. This is an example of something that we use for a spec sheet on a child product. It's a beach ball, and what we try to show is the basic information about the product, and then every standard that applies, what component of that beach ball it applies to, what the exact limits are, and then the second row, it may be too small for you to see, but that's all of the labeling that should be on that product, and then any special notes below. So that's just a good tool to provide to a supplier overseas if you import a product like that. Let's talk about import compliance. This is part of an overall compliance program for suppliers. Country of origin marking is required for anything that's imported outside of the U.S. and sold in the U.S. It's also going to be required for anything made in the U.S. and exported to Canada, for example. Every country wants a country of origin marking on a product that is coming into its country. It's there for a lot of reasons. One, to show consumers where it was made. But also to determine the duty rates or eligibility for special trade programs that might have reduced tariffs, like NAFTA, for example, or also penalties for high tariffs against countries that are, in the U.S.'s opinion, U.S. government's opinion, are competing unfairly, for example, or trade sanctions outright, such as against countries like Iran. Also for statistics and a number of other things, like to protect against mad cow disease if it's that a country has that coming in. And I mentioned earlier about chemicals coming into the U.S. If it's a liquid paste, putty gel, or a powder, then importers need to be able to demonstrate what chemicals are in there and go to the EPA-approved entry list for chemicals and certifying the entry documents to U.S. Customs that the chemicals in those liquids, paste, putties, and gels do fall on the entry list, the approved entry list. Let's talk a little bit about marketing claims, because this is, again, part of the gauntlet that products and everything associated with compliance go through. The general rule is don't mislead the consumer. Be honest and don't imply something that's not true, and certainly don't say it outright that's misleading. There are absolute claims, like made in the USA is an absolute claim that it was fully made in the USA of U.S. parts, with maybe a few minor exceptions, or a qualified claim, and using made in the USA as an example, made in the USA of U.S. and foreign components is a qualified made in the USA claim. Evidence supporting a claim needs to be reasonable. If it's a scientific claim, then it has to be scientific evidence. It needs to be reliable. Areas of concern on claims can be in made in USA, eco claims, health benefits, whether it's an over-the-counter drug or it's an antimicrobial product. There are products on the market that have antimicrobial additives in them, for example, in plastic, and those will kill a number of germs. But unless that additive has been approved by the EPA as a pesticide, then that claim is not supposed to promote a health benefit to the user such that it keeps you from getting the flu, for example, or a cold. It can only be promoted to protect the products and not protect humans, unless the EPA has approved it as a pesticide. And then product content and performance claims are also areas of concern. So if you're selling a chair and you're saying that it has a weight capacity of 300 pounds, there should be a static load test showing it passed 300 pounds, for example. Or if it's if it's apparel and it's made of 100% cotton, then there needs to be some validation of that. Okay, so let's look at made in the USA. There's a difference between the country of origin marking on products that are imported in. That's a mandatory law to put the English name of the country on the product where it was actually made. For example, just putting the word China on there is sufficient. It doesn't have to say made in China. It can just say China. That's a mandatory law for imported products. Made in USA is a privilege that can only be put on a product or in its advertising if the product meets the rules of Made in USA. And the Federal Trade Commission has a rule that says you can claim that a product is made in the USA, an unqualified Made in USA claim, if all or virtually all of the components of that product are of U.S. origin in the last substantial transformation of the product was in the U.S. In other words, the last major manufacturing process was in the U.S. So a negligible amount of foreign content is permitted under the federal rule. Well, California has a stricter rule. With a few exceptions, 100% of the components must be of U.S. origin, and the last major manufacturing process also in the U.S. There are a few minor exceptions for raw materials and things like that, but it's very difficult to have an unqualified made in the USA claim. So assembled in the USA is much easier to meet because not all of the parts have to be of U.S. origin. In fact, only a small percentage needs to be. But made in the USA assumes virtually 100% of the components were also made in the USA, and then all those components were manufactured into the final product somewhere within the 50 states for the Commonwealth of the U.S. Eco claims, I just want to point out a few of these. Biodegradable and compostable are virtually impossible to meet under the Federal Trade Commission guidelines. It has biodegradable means it just has to turn back into nature within about a year's time. There has to be a test to support that. And the entire product must biodegrade, not just a portion of it. So virtually no products in our industry will be able to meet that, or at least very, very few. Compostable is hard to meet because it has to be a product that's normally discarded in a compost pile, and very few people do that as a regular basis. Made of recycled plastic has one little issue there that will trip people up. Most places that manufacture plastic products have scrap plastic that is automatically ground up and reintroduced back into the plastic molding machines. It's called regrind, and regrind is not recycled plastic because it's just reused within the manufacturing process. So that's an area where people will make a mistake, and China doesn't understand that regrind is not recycled, so claims from China need to be investigated a little further on recycled plastic content. Let's talk about health benefit claims. We've talked about sunscreens. There are some limits on what can be said there. I've put back the claims that can no longer be made, like sunblock. Hand sanitizers. Actually, hand sanitizers typically have an active ingredient of ethyl alcohol at about 62%, and that's what kills germs. And just about every product like that, if it is tested under a time kill study, will come back with results that it kills 99.9 or even more percentage of most germs. But the FDA will not allow an absolute marketing claim of 99.9% of all germs. So first, you have to have a time kill test to prove that it does it, number one. And then number two, there needs to be some qualifier to say that it kills whatever that time kill test says it kills, 99.9 or 99.99% of many common germs, because it will not kill every single germ, and it's not tested against every single germ. So a slight qualifier there. And again, on antimicrobial products, it either needs to be approved as a pesticide by the EPA, or the claim must show that it simply protects the product. Quality is something that's well known to everyone. It's a good reminder to see that fit, form, and function are the pillars of a quality evaluation. When do you check that? Well, pre-production samples for sure. Also at the manufacturer's facility if you have the ability to do that. And then certainly in receiving and on the production floor during decoration, there are many opportunities to look for flaws, problems, and things like that. I think there are a lot of obvious areas to look for. I won't go through what to look for, but to make sure that it functions safely according to its intended purpose, especially those products like a folding chair or a lock blade pocket knife, like I mentioned earlier, are especially important to evaluate. And then I want to talk about sustainable development. There's a good definition from the UN that this is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Obviously, environmental stewardship is certainly a critical area. Social responsibility, safe and clean working conditions, and all the freedoms for the labor force, and no child labor, discrimination, and similar things are very important to the big brand companies. And economic stability, having a facility that is profitable and has growth potential, are all pillars of sustainable development. So I just wanted to mention QCA because it's a growing force in our industry, and just a quick mention of what it is. QCA is a Quality Certification Alliance. It's independent, and the focus is on five primary areas. It's certainly product safety and regulatory compliance, but also quality, social compliance, supply chain security, working with U.S. Customs to combat terrorism with respect to imports, and, of course, environmental stewardship. And there's a very rigorous audit process and ongoing annual audit process associated with QCA. And I think that suppliers that have been accredited by QCA are one step closer to being in an environment of compliance. So wanted to just give that brief explanation. Now we're at Q&A. I don't know if we have some questions out there, Colleen, about any parts of the presentation.
We have a few. Distributor submitted questions. The first one is, can you speak to CONEG or TICP packaging testing, especially when reusable bags are considered packaging?
I can speak to it in a very limited extent because, to be perfectly honest, we haven't gone to that next step of testing our packaging. Our packaging is pretty simple. It's cardboard boxes, and it's poly bags and egg crate type items, and there's just not a high priority on testing that as opposed to products and imprint inks. But CONEG is an assemblage of a little more than half of the states, and there's some standards there for limitation of certain chemicals in packaging. I don't see that it is something that is being demanded a lot by even the Disneys and the McDonald's right now, but it may certainly find its way into the mix. But the goal is to limit how much packaging is taken to the landfill with lead and mercury and certain other chemicals that will get into the groundwater stream.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to remind the audience that you can still send in questions using the Q&A box until we finish the webinar. Another question that we have is, what if a supplier is not QCA certified but has a product safety department and is knowledgeable? Is that still a supplier that's worth using?
Oh, definitely, definitely. QCA is just one more of those, things to look for as going to the next step. But there are a lot of suppliers that have very strong departments that simply haven't had an opportunity to look into QCA, may do that in the future. So definitely if the supplier has the department and has the knowledge and skill, and especially if you ask them for test reports and they can provide those, I think that's an excellent sign.
Okay. And another question we have from a distributor is, what types of questions should we be asking our clients so we make sure we are finding proper items that meet their needs?
So we're talking about questions that go back to the end-user customer, or are we talking about questions for suppliers?
I think for the end-users.
Okay. Well, one question that would be good to ask your end-user is whether or not the product is going to be distributed to children primarily, because depending on how it's decorated and the nature of the product, it could go from being a general purpose product that is subject only to the general purpose standards to being a child product, which is much more restricted and have stronger standards. So that's a question to ask if you think that might be possible. Sometimes an end user will have its own requirements for testing or particular standards. They usually will volunteer that. You won't have to ask for that. So if that individual, the question might give an example of what they might be thinking about, I could elaborate, but those are the items that come to mind.
Okay. I don't have any elaboration on that yet, but if it comes in, I'll let you know. Another question, going back to the CONAG and TICP packaging testing, how does that affect when totes are packaging?
When what is packaging?
When tote bags are considered packaging.
I don't think it applies to a tote bag. It only applies to the box and filler materials that the tote bag would come in. If a tote bag is handed out with a bunch of items in it, I don't think that is subject to CONAG.
Okay.
If that is the question that was asked.
Okay. And sorry, we're getting a bunch in right away. Are there any agencies that test for the safety of pet products specifically?
Pet products, definitely. FDA actually has oversight of pet products, but mainly food and similar things. There have been a number of Prop 65 claims on pet products. As you can imagine, some people consider pets humans, so the standards for pets are equivalent to standards for humans. So PVC and lead and phthalates and similar things apply to pet products just like they do products for humans. I don't know that the CPSC is focusing on that. They have a lot more to focus on with child products right now. But definitely, pet products are regulated.
Okay. And then another question we have is, for QCA suppliers, can distributors assume that most of their stock items have been tested, or do they need to watch out for a supplier's overseas department? Can they assume that every new product coming in has been tested, or do they need to keep checking up on QCA certified suppliers?
Now, QCA does not validate that every product is compliant. There's a test report for every product. QCA is like ISO in that it validates that there is a department, that there is expertise, that there are processes in place, and those processes are being followed, but they don't do an audit of all the testing. So you can never assume that any supplier, no matter how many accreditations through QCA, ISO, or any other organization, have 100% compliant products. So I would always recommend that no matter how many credentials a supplier can provide, that you do ask for test reports, especially on the more important products like the ones that I've shown, food and drink contact, child products, and similar things.
Okay. And another question is, can you clarify, does Prop 65 help to limit exposure of toxic substances to children, or is it to help protect adults?
It's for everyone. It's for the entire population, and the limits for the chemicals in Prop 65 really don't change between adults and children. So, as a general rule, if the CPSIA has a limit for children, you'll find that same limit to apply to children and adults in California. So, as a general trend, you're seeing products being sort of forced to comply in all 50 states to child standards by virtue of Prop 65 unless the supplier puts a warning on it.
Okay. And then I think just one last question that we have time for today is, can you explain decorated apparel and how that distributor and supplier relationship is different than the distributor-supplier relationship with a hard goods supplier in terms of product testing and product safety?
Well, I don't know apparel as well as I do hard goods because we simply don't carry much other than Nike and similar things, but I do understand that a number of distributors will buy apparel in blank and they will decorate it themselves or have it decorated locally. And at that point, the distributor becomes a supplier, and the obligations for compliance become a little heavier for that distributor. In hard goods, the distributor certainly has an obligation. We saw that with Ross Stores, that the retail seller of a product still needs to make sure that its products that it sells are compliant. But really, there's a much stronger burden on the importer, the manufacturer, and the supplier, such as ourselves. Decorating is just adding one more component to a product. And so if a distributor is going to decorate apparel, and especially if it's with an ink as opposed to stitching, then testing of that ink, I think, is something that's very important, especially for children's clothing.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Joe, for all the information you gave us today. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time for today. On behalf of Norwood and Bit Graphic North America and Promo Marketing, I want to thank you for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our new live event page on promomarketing.com to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. Please also take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your next screen. Your feedback will influence the events we bring to you in the future. I hope to see you at the next Promo Marketing webinar.